can dance like this. She make a man wanna speak Spanish. Como se llama?
Sí.
Bonita.
Sí.
Because I'm
Shakira, Shakira.
Oh, baby, when you talk like that, you know you got me hypnotized. So be right. I'm
Leroy.
Beating the size of my body.
Señorita, feel the conga. Let me see
you move like you come from Colombia.
Free Palestine!
Oh, sorry, wrong Colombia. Sorry, Shakira. Sorry, Wyclef Jean. We're talking about a little something different today. Because today is Thursday. And this is live from the studio, The Daily Edition. I'm your host, notably out of breath, Mr. Jimmy Selesky. Glad to be here with you folks. It's been quite the week. I finally want to get around to talking about this. It's been 8 days or something like that. It's been a while. It's been over a week since the original Columbia University protests broke out. And I feel the need to address them. There's a part of me that feels like they're just not going to stop until I speak on it. So thank me later, everyone, for putting in my 2 cents so we can finally bring an end to this madness. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with the Columbia University protests, which have now expanded far beyond Columbia University, but this is where they started, in New York City. If your cause can make it here, can make it anywhere, kid. The Big Apple. It started there as a tent encampment. My favorite type of protest. There's all kinds of genres of protests. You got your classic big crowd in an area protest. That's standard. We've all seen that one before. We've seen blocking traffic, specifically on bridges for some reason. That might be my least favorite one. It's certainly the most disruptive. And also, as we've talked about before, a lot of people are scared of bridges. And imagine if you're terrified going over the Golden Gate Bridge and then you find out some group of college kids is completely blocking traffic for the unforeseeable future. And you just have to sit there suspended, you know, 20 stories above running water. I just think that's just inconsiderate. And you'd think that this group of people, the protesty group of people, you know who I'm talking about, would kind of be aware of those things, you know, mental health, stuff like that. Doesn't seem like it matters. Kind of like how COVID suddenly didn't matter during the George Floyd riots. It's just weird like that. It's weird how that stuff works. Also, need I mention the Key Bridge in Baltimore recently? We've seen what happens with bridges. I don't know if we need to have, you know, 40,000 tons of people stuck on the Golden Gate Bridge for that long because of Palestine. But anyway, that's another genre. But the tent encampment, this is becoming an instant classic, is it not? I haven't seen this since the summer of 2021. Got to go all the way back to Chop Chaz. Remember Chop Chaz? You guys remember that during the Black Lives Matter, the BLM protests right after the George Floyd thing? There was like an entire section of, I think it was either Seattle or Portland. I can't remember which city it was. I want to say Seattle, but Portland just, it feels more on brand to have been in Portland. But I think it was in Seattle. There was an entire section of the city that had been basically just like taken over and declared themselves like a independent state, like just like some hipster neighborhood in Seattle. And it was like that for like 2 weeks. And at first it was called Chaz, and then it was called Chop. And the one thing I will say that I've noted about these types is they don't get the point of acronyms. For those of you familiar with acronyms, acronyms are when you take a long thing, like the National Association of America of Colored People, the NAACP, and you shorten it to something like NAACP. You make it shorter so you can abbreviate. It's like an abbreviation. It's an acronym. So the purpose of acronyms is to make stuff shorter. But if you ever notice, even the acronyms become long. Like, okay, we used to have gay, lesbian, trans. Then it was LGBT, which is arguably more, that it, not even arguably, that's more syllables. The acronym is longer than if you just said gay, lesbian, trans. You could really just get away with saying gay and trans, because that kind of encapsulates all of it. But no, they made an acronym that's longer than that, LGBT. And they said, but wait, there's more. And then they went LGBTQIAA. And then we were like, all right, are you done? Because your acronym is officially 12 syllables. And they said, I mean, we're not done yet. But I mean, I guess let's just put plus there just to let you know that we could keep going. We could keep going. LGBTQIAA plus. Just in case you thought we were... Hold on, wait a minute. Y'all thought I was finished. Speaking of gay. Sorry, Diddy. Anyway, that's just a thing I noticed. So even the Chop Chaz acronym, they couldn't decide on one name. They were like, screw it. Let's just be both names. That's what I call inclusivity. But this is another tent encampment, folks. A classic. A cool twist on a classic. At Columbia University. And as I said, it has expanded far beyond this. There are now demonstrations at University of Texas in Austin. Go figure. George Washington University. USC. That is University of Southern California. Not University of South Carolina. Just to avoid any confusion. I think there was some stuff going on at MIT. I heard University of Michigan. It's spreading. It's catching. It's going around. But Columbia is the originator, so I want to focus on Columbia today and just kind of speak on some facts. And today, hopefully in this show, when it's all said and done, we will have covered three main things. And that is, what is it? Who is behind it? And of course, how do we resolve it? I'm taking from my second grade journalism lessons there. Shouts out Miss Shank, who were friends on Facebook, Miss Shank, by the way. Shouts out. Who, what, where, when, why, and how. So we're going to focus on all of those things. We've already discussed the where, Columbia University and several other universities across the nation. We've already discussed the what. Let's get into the why. So why is this happening? From my understanding, this is, depending on where you stand on the Israel-Palestine issue, it is either framed as an anti-Israel protest or a pro-Palestine protest. It's kind of like the glass half full, half empty situation. Both are true, but you immediately know what side of the argument someone is based on how they describe it. Do they describe this as an anti-Israel protest or a pro-Palestine protest? The people protesting would describe it as a pro-Palestine protest. Some would describe it as a pro-Hamas protest, which is not the same as pro-Palestine. But we're going to get into all that, hopefully. The students have a list of demands. I have a list of demands. The people organizing it have a list of demands, a stated purpose. And their stated purpose is yet another acronym, BDS. That stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction. Not to be confused with BDSM, which stands for bondage, discipline, sadism, and masochism. That's an entirely different protest, but I imagine still a lot of mask wearing and weird outfits. But BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction, is the purpose of this protest. They want their university, being Columbia University, to divest of all money and endowments going towards pro-Israel companies, organizations, and other things that promote the Israeli apartheid state. And I guess the insinuation is they're not going to leave. They're not going to remove themselves from this tent encampment in the middle of campus until the school capitulates. Now, some interesting facts about Columbia University. First and foremost, it is a private institution. I think it's considered an Ivy League school. If it isn't, then it should be. But I'm pretty sure it is. I'm like 95% sure it is. I do know that it, last I checked, is the single most expensive university in the country. The average tuition is $66,139 a year. You heard that correctly. If you want a four-year degree from Columbia University, that is going to run you on average. This is just tuition, by the way. This doesn't include room and board, I don't think. You know, all the other things that go along with going to college. You got to pay $1 billion for textbooks for no reason, even though, you know, it could all much easier be accessed online. But the textbook industry and all. So $66,139. That a four-year degree runs you, apparently, somewhere in the ballpark of $265,000. That's a lot of nuts. That's a lot of money. $265,000 for a four-year degree. And that doesn't include postgrad, which I imagine pretty much everyone at Columbia is going to partake in. I don't think the average career path is just a bachelor's at Columbia. Now, the student body, a total enrollment, 36,649 students, of which about 8,500 are undergraduate. And something tells me it's really the undergraduates that we're dealing with in this protest. I say that to point out a few things. The three main things to focus on. This is an extremely elite college. It is the most expensive university in the country. And that is a rather large student body. As far as undergraduate, it's not that large, only about 8,500. But in terms of total enrollment, you know, Columbia Law School, I think, is a thing. There's a lot of post-grad stuff going on. We're talking close to 37,000 people. That's a big school. And the amount of people actually involved in this protest, first of all, not all of them are students. A significant portion of them are. But there is a lot of joining in from the public around. And I believe that the students may have agreed with the faculty or agreed to certain terms with the faculty after these many days at kind of an impasse. That non-students would not be participating on school grounds. So, in theory, there are no non-Columbia Law students demonstrating on school grounds in the tent encampment where that is, but there is a lot of action going on around the school in the streets of New York City, and likewise for all these other universities that are engaging in this. So depending on who you watch or what you watch, this is characterized in many different ways. And there's a couple things that I just want to get right out the gate. Those of you who follow this show on any level have seen me speak to the Israel-Palestine conflict several times. Maybe a little too much for somebody who claims to not really have that strong of an opinion. But to that, I would say I don't really have that strong of an opinion on the Israel-Palestine conflict. I do have a very strong opinion on why I shouldn't have to have an opinion. And so by that strange train of thought, I do wind up talking about this issue quite a lot. But it's not because I'm emotionally invested in either side. I think that Israel has a right to do certain things to protect themselves from terrorist groups operating in Palestine, Gaza, and wherever else. I think that they have overstepped the bounds of this conflict at several points, in particular, bombing the Iranian consulate in Syria, provoking a missile barrage from Iran on Israeli soil, and then retaliating, and then arguably just starting a never-ending back-and-forth escalation that may ultimately lead to some sort of global war. But that's neither here nor there. I do not agree with the characterization of quote-unquote genocide of the Palestinian people. I don't think that's a fair portrayal of what's really going on either. I think much like most things, the answer is somewhere in the middle. And I'm going to do what I believe is the right thing, which is just come right out front and say, look, I don't live in Israel. I don't live in Palestine. And I don't really care that much about what goes on over there. I wish everyone the best, and I hope they figure it out as soon as possible. I do care about what goes on over here, though. I find this protest interesting for many reasons. I fully understand that depending on where you line up on this issue, if you are someone who is very pro-Israel, you are going to immediately point to any incidents of anti-Semitism in this crowd, of which there undoubtedly are aspects of that. For sure there are. Now, whether or not this could be fairly characterized as an anti-Semitic protest, I'm not so sure. I'm going to have to take the tact of the old Trump classic, good people on both sides. I think that the more radical among those students are very much pro-Hamas. And there have been chants. There have been chants supporting Hamas. There absolutely have. I could play a clip here. And this isn't to say, this. I'm not using this to characterize the entire protest as this clip. But it is important that we entertain all aspects of what's going on and not just the parts that we care to acknowledge. So here is from The Hill. I'm going to show you this clip here.
Pro-Palestine protests continue unabated at Columbia University ahead of the start of the Jewish holiday, Passover. The school's president, Manush Shafiq, announced early Monday that classes will be virtual as reports of anti-Semitic and offensive statements and actions on and near the campus escalate, with many Jewish students reporting that they feel unsafe, according to reports. Demonstrators yelled at pro-Israel passerbyers. One protester repeatedly chanted, "We are Hamas," outside the university, but near the gates of Columbia, protesters chanted, "Hamas, we love you. We support your rockets, too." Now, Shafiq's decision follows growing calls for the university to increase protection. Columbia's rabbi took it one step further, urging students to go home as the campus teeters on the verge of a full-blown crisis. Writing for the Free Press, one Columbia student, Jonathan Lederer, says that he was standing in the middle of campus waving Israeli and American flags and singing peace songs with other Jewish students when protesters threw water in his face, and one protester held a sign that said Al-Qassam's next targets with an arrow pointing toward the Jewish students. Al-Qassam is the military branch of Hamas.
pro-Palestinian voices point out that the overwhelming majority...
Yeah, shut up. All right. So I don't believe that those incidents are made up. I actually saw a picture of what he was referring to towards the end. I might be able to find it for you real quick here, of that Al-Qassam's next targets. Yeah, so that's real. Also, couldn't help but notice that that's a white chick. Which just doesn't, I don't know. It doesn't, it almost makes me feel like, whatever. White chicks just say anything. You know, I don't necessarily know if that reflects the entirety. If it, I'll be honest. If that was like a Palestinian looking person with that sign, I would consider that like a legitimate threat. Sorry, I would. Hamas is Palestinian. If you're Palestinian and saying this is Hamas's next target, I'm more inclined to believe you than if Bridget from across the street says it. Sorry. I don't know how else I can put it. So, I don't know. Maybe just distasteful, whatever you want to look at it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that is a Muslim. I don't know. It doesn't matter. The point is, we all acknowledge that when you get this many people involved in something, there's going to be some bad actors. And that goes for all events, all right? The fact that I'm willing to extend this olive branch towards a protest that I don't agree with, and I'll get into why I don't agree with it in just a moment, but just know, and just take note of the fact that I am being very fair about this because I feel that this goes for all organized and unorganized events. This goes for January 6th. You can't selectively pick and choose which protests the actions of a small minority should be used to characterize the entirety of the event, and then other protests that maybe you sympathize with decide to ignore the extremist minority, not acknowledge them at all, and then say that nothing bad happened ever at all. I just don't think that's fair. I'm willing to do that for both sides. I'm willing to acknowledge that most people at any event are kind of just there. They're kind of just there. I believe that many of these students have very strong opinions about the Israel-Palestine conflict. I don't know how many of them would be willing to metaphorically die on that hill. I think that the university is enabling, Columbia University is enabling this to go on way longer than it should. And I don't think this is necessarily a free speech issue at all. There is an issue of Columbia being a private institution. I don't know how this extends to public universities. I would imagine that public university campuses are still semi-private property, right? Like, I can't just build a tent on University of Maryland campus or like, I mean, that is like trespassing, right? Like, if I'm not a student there, I don't know how that works. I do know, however, for a fact that a private university like Columbia certainly has the right to dictate what goes on its premises. And the fact that they have kind of had very little, you know, not nearly enough pushback to what's going on. They've moved to remote learning for classes. Can you imagine that, by the way? Just real quick. Can you imagine you are paying $67,000 per year to go to the number one most expensive university, one of the most prestigious universities in the country, and you're taking online classes? Can you imagine that? I remember that during COVID, I think all the schools in Maryland, I live in Towson in Maryland, just north of Baltimore City, they opened up in the fall of 2021 for that semester, Towson University did, And within 1.5 weeks, I want to say within 1 week, they moved completely to online classes. And that was after all the students had paid that semester of tuition and gotten moved into their dorms and paid for that, obviously, and all those other things. And only after that did they announce, oh, thank God you guys are all moved in and are paying for room and board and a semester of tuition, but just to let you know, we're taking all online classes. You can't tell me that wasn't planned. Online learning is nowhere close. I mean, first of all, college as a whole, you guys know, or maybe you don't know, you're about to find out now, college is a scam for most people. Unless you're literally going to become a lawyer or some type of hard science CEO or something like that that actually literally requires a college education, college is a waste of your time and money. It is. It has been for the past probably, I want to say, 20, 30 years. And it's only gotten more expensive as a result. But online college, they might as well not even have the, it's a joke. It's a literal joke. And because of what's going on Columbia University campus, they probably could have in-class classes. But, you know, certain students feel threatened by the thing, and so they don't want to make them, you know, involved in that. And I understand that, too. When you get to this level, it's all about money. When you're dealing with the richest people in the world and their kids, you got to bend in a lot of different directions. So I get all this. But the problem that I kind of have with the whole thing is the obvious old school Vietnam vet in me that just wants to say, do any of you have a job? How do you have this kind of time? I'm sorry, if you have time to exist in a tent city for 8 days and counting, you are doing something wrong. Maybe if you're 80 and you're retired, sure. But these are college kids. This is 18, 19, 20, 21, early 20s kids. None of you guys have jobs? None of you guys have other obligations? What is going on? And this is really the type of crowd that these things breed. This is why you always see this in college, because protesting is a symptom of privilege. It really is. It really is. If you have to work, this Tuesday at noon, you don't exactly have time to protest the apartheid state in Israel all next week. You just kind of don't. You just don't. And so only the most privileged, most unaffected among us have the time of day to engage in this type of demonstration. Basically, the people that should be taken the least seriously. And that's a weird thing to say when you're talking about supposedly the best among us, the most intelligent, of our college-aged people in the country, this incredibly expensive and prestigious elite Ivy League university. You would be thinking that that's not the case, but there's a reason for this. There's a lot of reasons for this. Part of me loves to see this. Part of me really loves to see this. Because college is, as I mentioned, college is a scam for 90% of people. And it's an indoctrination camp for 100% of people. It's what it is. Colleges, the cliche line, I don't care, it's true. Some things are cliche because they're true. College is not there to teach you how to think. It's there to teach you what to think. And we have been indoctrinating every class of kids for the past at least 20 years in leftist doctrine, anti-capitalist, anti-American, really, ideals, anti-free speech, all of the above. These are like the pillars of university culture in this country for decades now. And the same people, the same kids that 10 years ago or 8 years ago, however long ago, when it was a real big thing, when conservative people would come to college campuses to deliver speeches and the kids would stand outside and prevent them from entering the building, prevent people from entering the auditorium, and basically just strong arm the university into canceling the event. Now that doesn't really happen anymore because conservatives don't even attempt to speak at colleges really anymore. And colleges, well, either that, no, conservatives still would love to speak at colleges, but colleges don't even bother inviting them or even allowing it in the first place because they all know what's going to happen. So back before this was like an automatic no-go and we got to actually see what happens when a conservative does come to campus, that was what happened. So now that doesn't even happen anymore because they didn't even try anymore. But that same culture, those same kids, just a different group of them, different faces, same kids though, are now the ones doing the demonstrating. They're doing the same thing they've been doing. And that is disruption and strong arming. And you can say what you want. Again, I'm a free speech guy. I don't disagree with their ability to express themselves, but it does say something. It really does say something. That this is how they choose to express themselves. This is what they've been this is what they've been ingrained into doing. This is Columbia. Columbia Law. Again, how many times do I need to say this is a top institution? These are our future politicians, our future lawyers, our future diplomats, future CEOs of companies. These are the highest educated among us. And this is what they choose to do to get their point across. And this is a question that I don't think nearly enough people are asking. Everyone is sitting here, and depending on if you agree with them or not, to me, that's not the point. For those of us who understand business and the real world, maybe those of us who aren't 19 and think that every issue in the world can be solved with a witty chant and a bongo and a really neatly colored sign with a catchy slogan and an orange tent. Maybe those of us who understand that there's more to the world than that. We understand at the end of the day, this is, much like everything else, going to come down to dollar bill, y'all. Wyclef Jean said it best, not in the song we heard at the beginning of the show, but in his other great song, The Sweetest Girl. Dollar bill, y'all. What do I mean by that? I mean, once again, you're dealing with the richest people in the country sending their kids to Columbia. And we just noted that 8,500 of those kids are in undergraduate, meaning they're the ones that are primarily living on campus. They're the ones that are, I would say, probably overwhelmingly comprising these demonstrations at Columbia and across the country at every other school. This is definitely more undergrad activities, I'd say, you know. Not saying a 23-year-old or a 26-year-old wouldn't engage in this. There's certainly a lot of them too, but I'd be willing to bet most of these kids are 18, 19. That explains the not having a job thing. That explains having the time of day. That explains already being on campus all the time. Explains all that. 8,500 of them. This protest at Columbia is maybe a couple hundred. Maybe a couple hundred. So think about that. Anytime you see a couple hundred people, you assume it must be a big thing. It must be a big deal. But proportionality is a very important thing to consider here. What is 200 out of 8,500? I'm going to ballpark that math. I know that 850 will be 10%. 200 is less than a fourth of that. So let's call it let's call it about 2%. Is that fair? Let's call it about 2.2%. Whatever, 2% for short. So about 2% of the undergraduate population of this school. Now again, there's 36,000 total enrollment at this school. So what's a couple hundred out of 3,600? I mean, now we're talking almost less than 0.5% of people are actually actively engaged in this protest. That's not to say that there aren't, probably even the majority of the student body doesn't sympathize or support their cause. But the in terms of the actual kids engaging in this demonstration, a very, very, very small minority. And again, I'm not convinced that even them, even they, the majority of them, would be willing to truly die on this hill. Because again, what they're asking for is the divestment, what's the other word? Divestment, boycott, and sanction of Israel and pro-Israel companies by the university. And the way they're going to achieve that, in theory, I guess, is just exist in a tent city in the middle of campus until the university caves and, I guess, pulls all its money from these things or stops accepting endowments from things that support it. And it's like, okay. But the other side of this goes on only as long as it becomes more cost-effective to shut it down than to placate it. And by that, I mean, right now, they're working on a little over a week. People are already starting to get tired of it. Donors are already starting to pull money from the university. These things tend to naturally fizzle out anyway, because again, the vast majority of the people involved in this demonstration are not at all affected by it. It's just something to be a part of. It's something to do. It's national news and they're in it. They're a news story. It's cool. It's the happening thing. And I hate to say it, but that is the reality for most of anything. People, there's like a small minority of people that are actually about it. And then the overwhelming majority of people are just there until they're not, until there's something else to be a part of. That's just the reality. So this thing, I wouldn't be surprised if it's starting to fizzle out already. If not yet, maybe it is gaining a little bit of steam back because other colleges are joining in. But these things naturally steam out. Okay, the Chop Chaz thing fizzled out eventually. It lasted a couple weeks in the middle of Seattle. The police, like every liberal city in America, refused to do anything about it. You know, they try to create this communist utopia in the middle of Seattle, and they wound up having higher rates of crime, rape, theft, and all the above than, you know, in this horrible capitalist society that they were trying to escape. So, you know, if anything, the best thing you could possibly do is just allow them to play themselves out for longer than 2 weeks, apparently, and they demonstrate exactly why they're not the ones in charge of society and why they don't get to dictate how we do things. So in many ways, this is nice. In many ways, this is fine. But the minute the parents of the students that aren't participating in this demonstration start calling up the school, and I guarantee you this is already happening, and say, look, motherfucker, I'm paying you $65,000 a year to send my son or daughter to this school, and you got them taking online classes at the most prestigious Ivy League university in New York City. You got them taking Ivy League classes because a bunch of fucking hippies are on the lawn in tents. Get that shit figured out, or I'm sending my kid to some other school. Stanford, Yale, Penn, Harvard. I don't know. I guess you can't transfer to Harvard, but you get the point. You get the point. All right? When you're spending that kind of money, and the parents that have that kind of money have that kind of pull, And as we just discussed, the kids in the tents represent such an incredibly small portion of the student body that if the rest of the student body, sympathizing with it or not, clearly not enough to actually join in, but maybe just watch from the sidelines, but their parents eventually are going to be driven to a point to force Columbia University's hand. And it's only at that moment, unfortunately, that Columbia will do something. Because this is their private property. They have no obligation to allow anyone to set up an impromptu tent city in the middle of their campus and occupy it and shut down normal school operations for weeks on end. They have no obligation to allow that. They are choosing to allow it because they are caught in between a rock and a hard place. But the only thing harder than that rock and a hard place is when parents start knocking and start demanding they take action. Now, this leads us to the second leg of our discussion, and that is, who is behind all this? Now, that many people would consider a conspiratorial question, even the verbiage, who is behind it? But that's a real question, because from the outside looking in, we hear about things like this. We've seen these types of demonstrations. We've seen how these things pop up out of seemingly nowhere. And we just kind of get used to the idea that, yeah, sometimes a large mass of people suddenly gathers and voices their opinion in the same place at the same time. And that does happen, but that's usually more in the form of a riot. Protests are a little bit different. Now, going back to the January 6th thing, that's fairly straightforward. There was a day that already existed. It's an event that people already attend. Sometimes, I guess. I don't know. Needless to say, it wasn't that crazy to imagine why people ended up there. But when these things happen out of seemingly nowhere on a seemingly innocuous day in the middle of the week or whatever, and then all of a sudden, boom, everybody shows up with tents and signs and outfits and organizers, what is that? And that kind of led me down a rabbit hole of a lot of things, because I'm genuinely interested in this. This is something we hear about all the time. You know, George Soros with his Open Society Foundation funding, you know, protests across the country, funding these other groups, you know, funding BLM, funding whatever. And if you don't think about it, which I didn't really that much, because again, I just kind of looked at these things as just that's sometimes what happens. Sometimes protests just magically appear. But obviously that's not how it happens. Anybody who's ever tried to have a show, a concert, if you're in a band and you've ever tried to get your friends to come out and see you play a show, you understand how difficult it is to organize people. Okay? And that's your friends who, in theory, should want to come out and support you and your passion or whatever it is you're doing. This is a bunch of people that don't know each other who all come out at the same time to protest a cause that they actually don't have, for the most of them, any connection to. And so when you look at it that way, it does beg the question, how does this happen? And it doesn't have to be a conspiratorial thing. It just has to be an acknowledgement that this stuff doesn't happen because of magic. There is a lot of planning. There is a lot of organization. There is a lot of coordination that goes into these types of things that defy your interpretation of grassroots. And then you have the question of funding. Because organization is one thing. But, you know, some people are going to do that for free. Not everybody. We've already talked about professional activists on this show in the past. That's a real thing. Make no mistake. This article discusses the exact topic at hand, which is who is funding or is it being funded? The question, is it being funded, is a rather obvious question. Of course it is. At the very least, the people who organize this are on someone's payroll. Because again, these things don't happen by accident, and they don't happen because of the protest fairy. Somebody has to organize this. So this is from the Washington Examiner. It says, the pro-Palestinian occupation, called the Gaza Solidarity Encampment, is organized by a coalition of 116 groups called Columbia University Apartheid Divest. The organizations involved are numerous Columbia-specific groups or Columbia chapters of national organizations, including the prominent Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace. The CUAD's listed demands are divest all of Columbia's finances, including the endowment, from companies and institutions that profit from Israeli apartheid, genocide, and occupation in Palestine. The coalition of student groups also demanded that Columbia sever academic ties with Israeli universities and stop all, quote, land grabs, whether in Harlem, Lanapahoking, whatever that is, or Palestine. Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace have also been behind solidarity protests that have spread to multiple college campuses to support the Columbia student occupation, including at Harvard University, the Ohio State University, Boston University, and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. As a national organization for more than 200 chapters nationwide, the SJP, that's Students for Justice in Palestine, is known for protesting Jewish speakers, promoting the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction, or BDS movement, rallying other like-minded student groups. So, now we'll talk about the funding. According to Influence Watch, SJP, that's Students for Justice in Palestine, is a project of the Westchester People's Action Coalition, Westpac, I like that one, which supports BDS, the Green New Deal, and other left-wing projects, and has assets over $1 million. It says here, Jewish Voice for Peace, another major pro-Palestinian organizing effort in Colombia and across the country, has assets of over $2.8 million and has an ideology similar to SJP. According to Influence Watch, the group received $3.9 million from various donors, including from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, whose director Nicholas Burns resigned in 2017 for its support of the pro-BDS Justice for Palestine or whatever, Jewish Voice for Peace. JVP is also supported by far-left George Soros's Open Society Network, and since 2016 has hauled in at least $650,000 from Soros-connected groups. Okay. We get the point. So these are two groups of the supposed 116 that this Washington Examiner article claims. This article came out yesterday. These are just two groups that are identified as being heavily involved in this demonstration, in coordination, organization. And those groups are heavily funded by several different entities, including, apparently, George Soros, the Rockefeller Fund, and I would have to imagine a lot of other people. So these political action groups, I guess you could call them, these are like when your friend says they work for a nonprofit, this is like probably that type of thing. They have deep pockets. And they use those deep pockets to organize and fund movements such as, but not limited to, and not necessarily specific to what we're watching now. Again, to me, there is no question of whether or not these groups were involved in the organization of this demonstration. To me, there is no question that there is funding. To me, the question is, to what extent and why? This happens all the time. I actually, during my rabbit hole dive, discovered that even the whole situation with Rosa Parks was somewhat, let's say, put on. It was orchestrated in a way. The original girl who was kicked off the bus for refusing to give up her seat to a white man was named Claudette Colvin. And this is a picture of her. She was just 15 at the time. And she refused to give up her seat to a white person on the bus in Alabama, and was subsequently arrested. At the time, the NAACP was considering using this arrest of this young girl as sort of a jump off to spur the bus boycotts. But they ultimately came to the conclusion that a 15-year-old teenager was not the ideal face of a movement. The altercation, I think, was a little bit more hectic. It was a little bit more, you know, she was like dragged off the bus and, you know, kind of like fussing back and forth, understandably. I'm not saying I disagree with it, but the optics of it just weren't there. She got pregnant shortly thereafter. So now you have a pregnant black teenager who was semi, not so smoothly arrested in this demonstration. That's not the ideal face of a movement. Now, Rosa Parks was the secretary of the NAACP at the time and became actually quite close, apparently. This is based off my source, Drunk History. Notable Towson High School graduate, Derek Waters, does that show. So he's, I think, like 10 years older than me. But we went to the same high school, Towson High. They did an episode on this. It was a good episode. And they pretty much decided that they wanted to have this type of event to kick off the bus boycott, but the optics were way better if the older, more kind of soft-spoken, more palatable, lighter-skinned Rosa Parks was the face. And so they sort of reenacted it. Not that the police were in on it, but they pretty much kind of like set it up so that Rosa Parks was going to sit on the bus and somehow or another it was going to transpire that she was going to wind up being arrested and then be like, oh, I was just tired, as opposed to the other girl, Claudette, who was like, it's my constitutional right, and arguing with the cops. And again, I totally agree with her, but they kind of figured the optics of like an older, more refined, lighter skinned black woman who just kind of played the like, I was just tired. And they were like, this will be good. White people will eat this shit up. And they did. And I'm not saying that was wrong. Nobody disagrees with, I guess, the end result of, you know, the end of segregation. So it was done so for a good cause. But the point, the reason I bring this up is to say that, like, a lot of things that you thought were just kind of things that happened, that's not the case. In fact, the more I look into these things, the more I kind of discover that very few of the things that I had just assumed throughout my life were just organic grassroots events or movements that just kind of spurred up out of nowhere because of some burst in passion from the public. And usually that's not the case at all, you know? Again, not all of these things are done for evil or good necessarily. But the point is that this type of organization has to go into either side. And so when you hear things like, oh yeah, Rosa Parks, that woman who is famous for, you know, refusing to give up her seat to a white woman on a bus, like that was kind of planned out. You know, she was an activist. She worked for the NAACP. She was somehow setting herself up for a reenactment of an event that had already occurred with someone who that organization did not see as a suitable face for the movement. So they set it up for her to do basically the same thing, but a better face for the movement so they could launch the bus boycott and ipso facto whatever. So again, just another example of the level of planning and thinking that goes into this. So acknowledging that these things are planned and organized, and acknowledging that groups and organizations have deep, deep pockets to fund and coordinate these things, you cannot simply sit back with the mindset that I think most people have, including myself at times, which is that what we are witnessing is just a grassroots campaign of, you know, disaffected youths that are just tired of the way the world is working and have finally had it and are, you know, setting aside their busy lives of not ever having to work and going to the most expensive university in the country to speak for Palestine or whatever. There's more to it than that. That's all I'm saying. And you've probably heard the term paid protest. Oh, my, Jim, come on. I was following you until you said that. Hear me out. I'm not going necessarily where you think I'm going. You've probably heard the term paid protester in the past. Now, I'm not saying that the majority or really any of the students at these demonstrations are paid protesters. I'm not saying that. I'm really not. I'm not saying there aren't any, but I have seen college kids. I have experienced their vibe generally. I've been a college kid for 1 year. I was around it. I've been to protests. I know the types. And I have no problem believing that a significant portion of a college campus would be involved in this thing just because it's something to do. So no, I'm not saying that this is fueled by paid protesters. I am saying that I learned something about paid protesters today. And that is, it's kind of an open secret. And by open secret, I mean they're not really trying to hide the fact that this is an industry. And you might be sitting there thinking, well, if it's so open, if it's such open information, why don't we hear about it more? That's a great question. Or why didn't I already know about it? Why am I just hearing about it now? Or why are we just actually seeing evidence of it now? Another great question. I've been hearing about the term paid protester forever. I've been believing that there is such a thing for a while. But even I, who actually, you know, I spend an hour a day recording stuff about politics, even I have just come across this for the first time. This is something, this blew my mind today. Maybe it doesn't blow your mind, but let's take a look at this. I typed in how to become a paid protester on Google. And I scrolled down and I found a website called Crowds on Demand. And this is the website. Crowds on Demand. This is a real website. I looked into this. It says, Crowds on Demand is your home for impactful advocacy campaigns, demonstrations, PR stunts, crowds for hire, and corporate events. Services available nationwide. So I was obviously intrigued by this. So I was like, oh, let me request a quote. Okay, so request a quote. Let us know how we can help you. So obviously they're not just going to have like prices available on there. So you got your first name, last name, email, phone. I almost kind of wanted to send like something fake in as an inquiry just to kind of get some more information, because obviously they're not going to put too much stuff out there on the general website. But I figured I probably should use like a fake email, because if I just use like my email, they could very easily search me and know that I'm not serious, like whatever. So maybe we'll do that. Maybe I'll do that when I get a chance and we'll follow up on that. But in the meantime, let's go back to this quote. Okay, so here's the next section. It says, how can we help? Please include as much detail as possible. Details might include some of the following. Information on your organization, why you're reaching out to us, what services you're interested, blah, 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 blah. All information we receive will be kept confidential regardless of whether we end up working together. If you are not comfortable including every detail, please at minimum let us know what type of services you're interested in. Protests, rallies, corporate PR stunts. Please note that we generally do not take on any customers with an event or campaign budget under $20,000. Okay, so this is no small bones here, guys. This is not a joke. It says budget. Given the extensive work needed to make our events, demonstrations, and campaigns come to life, we typically do not take on new clients with event or campaign budgets under $20,000, particularly for any work involving demonstrations. If your budget is under $20,000, please provide details about why we should consider the project. For example, if it is a non-controversial project, a philanthropic endeavor, or a project requiring only advisory services from Crowds on Demand. So let's take a look at this budget. $20,000 is the minimum. That's down here. Budget is under $20,000. Please specify in the how it can we help. So if you're not planning on spending at least $20,000 for this service, you're going to have to give them a pretty good reason why they should even waste their time working with you. $20,000 is the minimum. And then we take a look, and other budget ranges include $50,000 to $100,000, $100,000 to $250,000, $250,000 to $500,000, $500,000 to $1,000,000, and over $1,000,000. That's a checkbox. Some one guy had that. This is a normal selectable option. $1 million budget for this website to provide crowds at your events. Now, again, I don't use this to A, suggest that that's what's going on at this Palestine thing. I'm not saying that at all. I also don't use this to suggest that every single event that uses this service is necessarily nefarious. However, can we at least now acknowledge that this is a real thing? This is a real industry. This is just one company, by the way. This isn't the only company. This appears to be the most open and vocal company, though. They don't seem to be too worried about, I don't know. To me, this is like snitching on yourself, right? Crowds on Demand was funded by Adam Swart in 2012 to change how advocacy is done. Since then, we have become the source for creating movement and building impactful events. This is Adam Swart. If he doesn't look like a fucking sleazeball, I don't know who does. Says Adam Swart founded Crowds on Demand as a college student at UCLA in 2012 because he understood the power of a crowd to shape people's perceptions. The same speech by a politician has a different meaning if it is given in front of 1,000 people instead of 10. A routine conference becomes controversial when 50 protesters are outside. An ordinary product launch becomes a newsworthy event when delivered with fanfare and flair. We create movements from the ground up on something as simple as a local building and zoning issue or as complex as an international business dispute. We create advocacy groups and staff them with suitable leadership. We also provide phone banking and mass emailing services with global capabilities. So I'm scouring through this website and I'm seeing all kinds of things about, mass letter mailing to congressmen and things like that. It's a paid advocate. It's literally what it is, a crowd on demand. The reason I bring up Crowds on Demand, and maybe you didn't find that compelling, I certainly did. I didn't realize, I knew that paid protesters exist. I didn't know that they exist to this level of like normality. You know, $1 million budget. The reason I bring this up is because now I want to talk about what even they say, you know, a conference, a seminar or whatever becomes controversial when there's 50 protesters outside. So you can fake public outrage. You can beef up support or the optics of support for a cause using these services, of which there are many. And when you're talking about budgets, you know, minimum $20,000 budgets for this company, at least. This is not to be used by people like you or me. I'm not spending $20,000 to have people stand out front of Nacho Mamas and talk about how awesome I am playing guitar next Friday. Who has the money to pay for these things? Political organizations. And the final leg of this conversation is, of course, what do we do? What does Columbia University do? What do we do? And by we, it's not really much I can do. I'm not involved. But the universities sure are, and we are focused primarily on Columbia. That's where it started. That is the biggest demonstration that I'm aware of. And what I find very interesting about this portion of the conversation, this question, how do we solve it? What is the university to do? You obviously have many people saying, well, clearly their students are expressing a strong opinion that they don't think that their school that they're paying to go to should be involved in these, investing in companies and organizations that are supporting what they believe to be a genocide and whatever, an apartheid state. And so the school should take heed and you know, make some changes, negotiate, come to the table. Okay. And then you have other people that say, you know what? Call in the freaking National Guard, get these kids off the lawn, and if they refuse to leave, arrest them and then expel them. And we'll see how many of those kids care that much about Palestine when the threat of losing their prestigious Columbia University degree is taken away. And the fact that it's a small minority of kids that are doing this, the vast majority of the student body, even though they might express it, it's bullshit, I can't believe they did that, trust me, a lot of those kids are going to pack up and go home. And the ones that don't are going to be arrested or expelled. And then all the other kids that didn't get expelled or arrested are going to sit there and whine about it for a couple weeks, maybe even days. But ultimately, they're not going to leave the university, because the only thing that matters more than making sure that their $66,000 a year doesn't go to an apartheid state and the genocide of the Palestinian people is that their $66,000 a year does go towards them getting a Columbia Law degree and making a ton of money when they're older. And so when they're forced to choose between those two, you'll be amazed how easy that decision becomes for a lot of people. You see this all the time. And I'm not saying that the university should take that harsh of an action immediately, necessarily. We'll talk about that. But you see this all the time when people talk about, like, we need, you know, workers' rights, workers' comp, a livable wage, environmental restrictions, and all these things that people believe in. They believe are human rights, and I don't even disagree with them. And then you say, okay, so, but like, you do realize that, like, in these other countries where we're getting most of our products manufactured, like, your iPhone is not made in America, where they have to be paid the American standard wage and they have to abide by certain environmental restrictions for carbon emissions and dumping of waste. And, you know, they can't work them 120 hours a week and all these other things, you know, workers' comp and all these other things that go into operating a business in the United States. That's not what goes into your iPhone. What goes into your iPhone is whatever laws they have going over in Indonesia and China or wherever they're manufacturing these things, where, believe it or not, they don't really care all that much about their carbon emissions and how hard, how many hours a week the factory workers are working and whether or not their wage is livable wage. Spoiler alert, it's not. That doesn't matter to them. But ultimately, the argument always comes down to, you know, if you say, well, what we need to do is we need to place a tariff on these countries who aren't abiding by our standard. And instead of supporting these sweatshop factories in other countries, we should be bringing these jobs to America where we can ensure that these products that we're, you know, funding, putting money towards, these companies that we're propping up, are treating their workers fairly in our country, where that's actually going to be a principle. People go, yeah, but you have any idea how expensive an iPhone would be if it had to be made in America? And I say, yeah, it would be expensive. It would be the amount it should be. I don't have an iPhone, so I don't have any skin in the game. But I guess my point is basically you care a whole lot about human rights and workers' rights and livable wages and the environmental restrictions and all those things up to you not being able to afford your $1,000 iPhone anymore. Because if the iPhone had to be made under proper conditions, it wouldn't be that cheap. And that's about the line that most people go. Literally have people say, yeah, but it would just be too expensive to be made here in America. Okay, so I guess your line is $1,000. If something costs more than $1,000, I am fine with somebody getting paid slave wages and worked to the bone and having no rights whatsoever. Because I need my iPhone, because if I don't have my iPhone, then I won't be able to tweet about how much I care about human rights. And that's most people. But anyway, I'm not saying that the university should just call in the National Guard and get these motherfuckers out of there. I am saying what I believe should happen, and this, again, is something I'm amazed more people haven't talked about. Once again, these are our future lawyers, our future diplomats, our future politicians. These are, quote unquote, the most elite, the best among us. And yet their means of expressing or negotiating or advancing their cause is disruption and basically kind of extortion, fear tactics, because there is a fear element to it. If you don't believe that, let's see how you feel if 100 people just set up camp on your front lawn for a week talking about how you need to do this, that, and the third. There's an intimidation element to that. Obviously, that's why they do it. But this is college. This is university. This is a place for different ideas to be expressed and debated and honed and hashed out. And what these students are being told, what they have been told, and this is the beauty of the whole situation, because these colleges have fostered this type of environment, which has taught students that debate is not something to be sought after. Diversity of opinion is not something to be sought after. What is to be sought after is your opinion and then an expression of power and intimidation and disruption in order to achieve your cause. And not being open to the other side, not tolerating the other side, not hearing them out whatsoever. It's a struggle for power. Whoever can cause more of a disruption, whoever can intimidate the other side more, whoever chickens out first loses. And that's what they have been taught. That's how they go about everything. That's what the bridge blocking is about. That's what the cancel culture shit was about. And that's what the tent encampment shit is about here. That's what it's about. And that's not supposed to be what college is about. I don't understand why if you're the college, if you're the chancellor or the dean or whatever the hell it is at college, why don't you get there and say, look, I understand that many of you have this opinion. I also understand that many of you don't have this opinion. And this is a college. Many of you are studying to become lawyers, which is the literal art and job of debating, of proving your point over someone trying to prove their point. I'm trying to prove this guy's guilty, you're trying to prove he's not, or vice versa. And at a university, the way we should be going about ideas and diversity of opinion, difference of opinion, is by having an open forum of debate where those of you who believe that this university needs to divest and boycott and sanction the apartheid state of Israel and stop supporting the genocide of the Palestinians, you should voice your opinion clearly, cogently, convincingly, against those of you who do not believe that that is the state of affairs. And you should also have to voice your opinion clearly, cogently, and convincingly. And now we have provided a forum for honest, open, hopefully good faith debate between two opposing sides of the argument. And if these kids were taught that in college, but not even that, in grade school, public education, anywhere, if this country valued that still, then that's what we'd already be seeing. But they haven't been raised on that. They haven't been taught that. This is what they've been taught. This is how they've been taught to handle a disagreement. And so now it's coming full circle and it's biting back against the college that taught them to do this. It's literally biting the hand that feeds you. It's the snake eating its own tail. It's a beautiful thing to see. And what would be even more beautiful is if this type of thing finally was the catalyst to spur colleges into not only putting their dick on the table and saying, look, you rich, spoiled brats who are all LARPing as revolutionaries, well, let's see how hard you want to LARP. Let's see how committed you are to the cause when you lose your chance to have that shiny new Columbia law degree that's going to make you be able to make all kinds of more money than your friends. And instead, you have to go to University of Maryland or, I don't know, West Virginia University or some public college. Ugh. And be like the rest of those gross blue-collar families. Let's see how much you care then. And in the meantime, instead of setting up a tent and chanting stupid shit all day every day and skipping class, we're going to hold class. Anybody who continues doing this will be arrested or expelled, whichever comes first. And what we will do instead, like adults, is we will have a forum for you to communicate your ideas and debate your ideas with those who don't agree with you, as opposed to seeing who can scream louder. And also bear in mind that this is not a democracy. We are a private institution. If you're just learning that now, students, if you're just learning now that college is a business, well, thank us later. There's your first lesson in the real world. We are a business. And if we determine that we want to continue investing our money into the companies we so choose, we will. But you will not be deprived of an opportunity to express your opinions. And we can talk about it all day, every day, because that's what college is supposed to be about. And if at the end of the day, we continue doing what we're doing, and you don't like it, you are more than welcome to go somewhere else. Because there are plenty of people in this country that would happily take your place. And that's what I think they should do. They should not shut down the conversation, but they should start the conversation, because this is not a conversation. This is a shouting match. And no, I don't particularly respect it. I don't. You know, the specifics can all be hashed out, whatever the university thinks makes sense, but this should be used as an opportunity to somehow kind of edge in the value system of debate and conversation and discourse back into our education system, because we are absolutely flailing without it. And yeah, I think that might amazingly be all I have to say about that. That's all I have to say about that. Folks, thanks for tuning in to another daily installment of Live from the Studio. My name is Jimmy Selesky. Please hit us with a subscribe so you can see when we release new content, once again, every Monday through Friday with myself, and on weekends with Eric Glazer and myself for the Live from the Studio podcast. So that's 6 days a week minimum of content, generally. And, you know, it's probably the best way to see when we release it, because our algorithm is not our biggest fan. I can't imagine why. Otherwise, you know, toss us a like on the videos or a dislike. Apparently, it doesn't matter. I would prefer a like, though. It makes me feel better. But apparently, both help push us up, so whatever. The worst thing you can do is not acknowledge us, really. Kind of like the protesters. And leave us a comment. You know, hate us, love us. Again, doesn't really matter. Just happy to be heard sometimes. At LFTS Podcast across the board. Till next time, folks. Peace.